Hi, it's Jeff, host of the podcast. My latest author interview will be up in just one moment. I'm not going to ask you to buy anything. I'm not going to ask you to go and review the podcast. What I am going to do is take just one brief moment and ask you to recommend the podcast to just one friend. If you're a writer, or if you're someone who just loves books and you love this podcast and the interviews that I do, all that I ask is that you recommend the podcast to just one friend. Thanks a lot. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Claudia Rees, author of the new novel, To Kingdom Come, the fourth book in her art history mystery series. Claudia, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Well, if someone listening hasn't yet heard about your new novel, To Kingdom Come, how would you describe the novel?
To put it into context, as you said, this is the fourth novel in the series. And the main characters who continue throughout the series are Erica Shawn, and art editor at Art News, and her slightly more seasoned colleague, Harrison Wheatley, who is an art history professor at NYU Fine Arts. And they started their relationship doing a more or less an academic research project, which turned somewhat deadly, and they were solving crimes in the art world and gained somewhat of an interesting reputation in their niche of their community, the art community. And in this book, sorry, this isn't an elevator pitch. In this book, the two are on a hunt for a cache of art and artifacts that were looted during the colonial era. And more specifically, it refers to or pivots on the what the British called their punitive expedition in 1897 into the Kingdom of Benin, which is in modern day Nigeria. By the way, everyone makes this mistake. I did it as well.
Sure.
Along the way, they become embroiled in present day murders, and there are some twists and turns in this. And this is no way a treatise, you know, a moral treatise of any kind. But I felt obligated to write this, and at least research it, and at least study this, because I had come across an article in the newspaper about these stalled attempts to return some of this art to Africa. I had actually a baptism by fire by reading David Hicks' book, The Brutish Museums, which is always misspelled, and I have to correct. It is the Brutish Museums, I don't have it on hand, the date that it was published, but it was quite recent.
Right.
But it was, as I said, a baptism by fire, because he gives a very dramatic description of what went on in 1897. This was in retaliation for an incident that had occurred a month or so earlier, when there were several people from Britain, and their carriers, about a group of about eight. Phillips was the head of this group. And they went to the Kingdom of Benin to negotiate a trade agreement with the Oba, or king of Benin. And they were advised not to enter the compound on that particular day because it was a holy day and they would be disturbing the souls of ancestors. But they disregarded this, promptly marched into the compound and were immediately killed. This punitive expedition, as they called it, took place just a short time later. And the retaliation was way out of proportion to anything that might have been expected. They just devastated the area. They decimated the place. Or more than decimated, that's only 10%. And the villages around the compound, they just, you know, went to hell with themselves and really caused quite a devastation. And that was the end of the Kingdom of Benin or the way it was governed at that time. It's been reconstituted, but it's not quite the same glory that it was.
And I'm curious, what other research did you do about this topic? Because I'm no expert, but certainly, as you said, of reading this newspaper article, I've certainly read about the issue of museums coming to terms with, you know, how they ended up with a number of African art. In their collection. So I'm curious, what other research did you do as you were writing to Kingdom Come?
Okay, well, and I'm looking at it now, the Hicks book, which was published by Pluto Press in 2020. And I also read Metropolitan Fetish, African Sculpture, and the Imperial French Invention of Primitive Art by John Warren Monroe, Cornell University, 2019, and The Art of Benin by Nigel Barley, the British Museum Press, 2010. And, along the way, articles that I was reading online led me to other articles, and I didn't enumerate them in my end notes, but I did a lot of reading, and hopefully I didn't make too many errors in my references.
Well, I wonder if you could take us back. What was your initial writing journey that led you to write and get your first art history mystery novel published?
I guess it's a long and a short story.
Well, you can tell it's a long. That's fine.
Okay. Very early on, the love of art was ingrained in me. It was what you'd call an organic relationship with it, because it was associated so early on with my family and family outings. And in fact, my brother became an art historian in this environment. And as I said, very early on, we would go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Modern Museum, and also the Frick, and a number of others, but less frequently than the Museum of Modern Art and the Metropolitan. And very often after our outings, we would order Chinese food takeout, and around the kitchen table, we would talk about what we'd seen. So this love began very early on. Later on, many years later, I got interested in the senior side of the art world, and the amalgam of the most sublime instincts of man and the basest seemed to make for wonderful fiction, or, you know, attempts at wonderful fiction. And so I became interested in writing about this. Now, I spoke to my brother about this. I said, I really would like to write an art mystery. I didn't call it an art history mystery at that time. And he said without losing a beat, well, why don't you write something about trying to track down a lost presentation drawing or sketch for Michelangelo's Battle of Cascina, which it was a fresco that he was commissioned to do, but it was never completed. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I serendipitously thought about an incident that had occurred years before when I was at Bess, or it was my beginning of my freshman year, and I was sitting on the edge of my bed talking to a dorm mate. This was in ancient times, BC, before co-ed. And I was this pipsqueak from Brooklyn, and I was surrounded by debutantes. And she was talking to me and telling me about what, you know, she had done during the summer. And she said, "And where did you summer?" And I said, "On my front porch." And then she proceeded to tell me quite casually that her father had recently lost his sugar plantation in Cuba because it was seized by Castro's rebels.
A fly.
And during the Cuban Revolution. And did you say something? I'm sorry.
I was just making a joke. I said tough life. I just said tough life.
Yes. Yeah. And for some reason, this conversation coincided with my brother's suggestion. And so I put together the story of an American owner of a sugar plantation in Cuba. And he happened to be an art collector. And his art collection is stolen by a group of Castro wannabes who had to raise money for arms, and then it proceeded from there. And so my prologue was just the incident that took place in 1958. And then it switches to a gala at the Pierre Hotel where Erica and Harrison are put together to and meet a woman who is related to this incident. She's the daughter of the person who had lost the plantation. I should say here that the relationship of Erica and Harrison progressed throughout the series. It starts as sort of a burgeoning romance with lots of foreplay, of course, so it doesn't culminate too early. And then in future books, they get married. They have some problems, and they now have a child. But the books themselves stand alone. You don't need to know as a prerequisite for reading any of these books. You don't need to know their history. And of course, I give some of it each time. But let's see, fun of writing a series.
So, are you working on another novel now?
Yes. I've just gotten started with it. I think I know where I'm going with it, but I don't want to give too much of it away.
Sure,
and
sure.
Somehow the spoilers and the explanation are sort of compacted in one sentence. So let's just say it's about the Impressionists, sure. Monet and the Impressionists, and something that goes awry in the early part of the 20th century and remains latent until the present day when our amateur sleuths are working on the problem that has arisen. And of course, there will be some murders involved as well.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sure. Well, I'm curious, what is your writing process when you're working on a novel? Are you someone who does a detailed outline before you begin, or do you just have a general idea about a piece of art history and you just kind of dive into the narrative to see where it takes you? Can you tell us a little bit about your process?
Well, I guess I'm sort of in between the compulsive outliner and the let's just ad lib it and just sit down at the computer. I have these 5x7 cards, and I jot down ideas. I jot down plot points, and this is after I've done a lot of reading and jotting down just general ideas. I jot down, you know, plot points, and I have them all scattered all over. Mm-hmm. And then I put them in order, which I think they're going to appear in the book. And of course I'm constantly shuffling and adding and deleting and so on. But that's basically the way I work. But I have to start with a definite hook, a definite pivot. And, I usually take, a few contemporaneous characters from a particular time period and sort of like put them together in some odd kind of way or interesting way without being unfaithful to either the era that they're in or their personalities or what they've done in life. So I create a scenario that might have been, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. So, and that's
which I think is what a lot of historical mystery writers do.
Yeah. it's a very interesting dilemma sometimes, this combination of fiction and nonfiction.
Right.
And where to begin and where to end it. And yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that makes the writing kind of interesting and exciting at the same time.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories or novels?
Well, I would say, first of all, to persist no matter what, even in the face of rejection and so on. But stick to your core values, but not tenaciously. Stick to your core values tenaciously, but don't stick to your method, your form, your grammar, you know, things like that. Don't stick to that zealously, because you know you might get really good advice. I know I've been in the company of writers who will not give up certain words, certain phrases, certain things that, you know, habits. And I mean, I've certainly learned a few lessons along the way. And like just in this recent novel, To Kingdom Come, I had a good friend, writer, read the book. And she said, do you need, you know, all what goes on between chapters 27 and 29? And I said, let me look at this. And I said, no. And I realized that one chapter was impacting the movement, the momentum of the mm-hmm. of the novel, and it was sort of idling. And what I did was I took out the chapter. I took out one or two sentences or expository facts, put them into to the prior chapter, took out another factor too and put it into the next chapter and tossed it. And it went much, much more smoothly. And if I had been resistant to that suggestion,
right,
it never would have occurred. And sometimes you find if somebody corrects you in some way or says, how about trying this? Or do you need this adverb here? I've tossed out many an adverb, and I think Stephen King, in fact, has said adverbs are the path to hell, pave the path to hell. And because sometimes when someone brings something up, you realize this has been sort of a nagging little complaint or criticism you've had for, on your own. And you finally say, yes, yeah, she's right. And you make the correction. And also I would suggest to someone, well, this was wandering. I would suggest to have a kind of ritual, especially when you're not feeling the mood strike you, you feel kind of blocked or you're not. Yes. And so what I've done is I brew a cup of tea and I put it in a special place. I have to open my desk drawer, because it's so narrow, and put it in my drawer. I have my tea. And I put on my sneakers, because I'm going to first, before I make the tea, I should explain, I do some rowing stationary rower. And then I brew a cup of tea and then I sit down to the computer. And once that ritual is gone, I can't take it back. I'm sitting there. I've got to do something. So I either shuffle my cards or write a dialogue that I think is coming up, so I don't have to just go right into, the next line of what I'm working on. And sometimes I just, the pure rhythm of riding on the rower and making the tea and sitting down will propel me into writing. And sometimes I forget to take my second sip of tea.
That sounds like a good ritual.
Yes.
I have read that there are, I wouldn't say studies, but there are, creative people who do have that kind of rhythm, and it just kind of tells their body and their mind and their creativity that,
yes,
now's the time to start writing. Well, I'm curious, what books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Well, recently I read Neal Stephenson's Fall or Dodge into Hell. In Hell. It's called Fall or Dodge in Hell. Mm-hmm. It's a fantasy that my a very long book that got absolutely rave reviews, and but some real pans on Amazon by some of his most avid readers. So I'm in a little mini book club with my son and my granddaughter, both of whom are really avid readers. And
that's great.
So this was suggested by my granddaughter. And so we had a big discussion on it after we reread it. And it's really great fun. And another book that we've recently read is Kazuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant. Mm-hmm. And I recently read, not in my book club, Never Let Me Go. I had seen the movie and I loved the movie. And my son had said that he didn't like the book at all. So, of course, I had to read the book. And I think I liked it more than he did. But yeah.
Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your novels?
Okay. Well, my website is ClaudiaReeseBooks.com. And nobody but my closest relatives spell my name right. So it's R-I-E-S-S.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Claudia Reese, author of the new novel, To Kingdom Come. It's the fourth book in her art history mystery series. The novel is available now, so go buy a copy. And Claudia, thanks for doing this interview.
And thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
The following is an excerpt from To Kingdom Come, a novel by Claudia Reese, published by Level Best Books. An international Zoom meeting is in progress. The participants' mission is to expedite the return of thousands of artworks and artifacts looted from Africa in the 19th century during the colonial era. Damn it! A mild curse, barely audible, but loud enough to light up the frame around Timothy Thorpe's image. Sorry, mates. Bulb blew. The overhead, it must have been, since the weaker source of light behind his computer was still there, softening his features and maybe for a millisecond the audience's attentiveness as well, so that when the black line appeared just above his shirt collar, it took another blip in time for brains to sort it out and reject the idea of a shadow cast by his desk lamp, which would explain the silence before the first scream, coming from somewhere in the Zoom's mosaic, a woman's scream. Mine, Erica realized. Likewise, a delayed reaction from Tim himself, gazing wide-eyed at the screen as if someone out there was experiencing the horror, not he himself. That is, before the black cord tightened around his neck and the impossible truth contorted his features like a funhouse mirror. And then the silence turned into the Tower of Babel, witnesses reverting to their native tongues as gloved hands, surely visible from the start, tugged on the cord and disappeared behind Tim's neck to knot or entwine or do whatever was planned or improvised to cut off Tim's air, while Tim clawed at his neck in an attempt to free himself, mouth open in a parody of Monk's The Scream. Except in Tim's version, it was a cry for help, mimed to the restless viewers filling his computer screen, twinkling with their useless babble like Christmas lights. Où est-il? Where is he? Monsieur Robert Lebec cried, his red cheeks deepening to scarlet, his returning to the group's common tongue, a sign that rational interchange was being restored. The museum! His office at the British Museum! Ike yelled back as if calling from across a football field. He said they're preparing an exhibit, staying late. I've got their unlisted number, seeing if I can rouse the damn security guards. All the while fumbling with his cell phone. They must seal off the exits. Museum doesn't close for another half hour. Bastard, we see you! Harrison shouted at the nondescript torso, mostly hidden by Tim's body, rigid against the chair back while his hands flailed like a mad conductor's. How many seconds had passed? 10? 15? A lifetime. Someone over there, call 911. Olivia? I've already put in the call. It's 999 over here, Olivia advised, her calmness, real or staged, a reminder that order was possible. I'm activating the recording option, Ike bellowed. Shifting focus to his unresponsive phone, he shouted, Hello? Hello? Harrison tapped on Thorpe's name and spotlighted his square. Instantly, it filled the screen. He dove for his cell phone. Erica, take photos! His words sounded harsh, except she was thinking the same thing, already digging her cell phone out of her jeans pocket. You video, I'll take stills. Oh, God! Outwardly, Tim had stopped struggling. But what was happening within? Her empathy was suddenly gripped by a primal curiosity, as if only by understanding Tim's encounter with death could she prepare for her own. Go! Harrison prompted. The command cut off her connection to Tim like a dropped call, and she aimed her cell's lens at the motionless figure in the more useful role as witness to a crime. As she prepared for the second shot, she realized that others were following Harrison's and her lead. On screen, the assailant's gloved finger pressed against Tim's neck, feeling for a pulse. Apparently satisfied, he or she swiftly removed the cord from around the victim's neck and made adjustments to the distribution of weight so that the body would not slump forward. Mission accomplished, the individual glided out of Tim's camera range, leaving Tim, in jacket and neatly knotted tie, to stare blankly into space with only an angry red bruise above his shirt collar to suggest what had just happened to him.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.